I'm going to base these font sizes on the sound that a duck makes on March 3rd on a mountain in Japan. Or
hashtag, geez, Chris. Hey there, Shopping Maniacs, you're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Shop.
We are so far into this thing, man. 307. Oh, can you believe it?
It feels like we've been doing it for 307 times.
Yeah, you know, and I don't want to be one of those podcasts that drones on and on in the beginning about nothing before you get to the meat of the show a little bit, but it does feel like, holy cow, we're so far into this, like, are we still finding new audiences? Are we still, or are we just like a dinosaur of this thing? Like, not to like bring up something like quintessentially like, oh God, are we doing things correctly in our lives in the world?
Yeah, but you surprised me with an existential crisis.
I know, but like, I'd like to know. I guess it's a shout out to the people listening. Like, are you, I know some people like say, or at least claim that they've been listening since the beginning. And I hope we have some of those hardcore longtime users out there. Cause that's so awesome. You know, thanks. Tell us who you are too. That would be nice to know. But I'd also be interested to know is like, is this the third show you've ever listened to? Are we still finding people out there, or do we need to, you know, I just want to hear from you. That would just be nice to know. I'm not doing like demographic data in which to share with our advertisers. I'm doing demographic data because I want to know who you are, and you know, just maybe we need a new logo, even though ours is perfect and amazing and we should never change it. I don't know.
Yeah, no, that is interesting. It's like with podcasting or any RSS based medium, you don't know when people, because we're not tracking you, like you're not zapped into our CRM or anything like that. We know an averagey number of listeners that listen to the episode a month, but we don't know when they joined or how long they've been listening.
Yeah. We don't know any of that. To some degree, it's like, what if, and I hate to make this comparison because it's the one that everybody always makes, but whatever, like This American Life, they're not going to change their name. That would be stupid. They have an incredible brand, and surely they grow and grow and grow because they do amazing work as a podcast, and they should. But they're at a point where like, they're like, duh, like, of course we're going to keep going. This show is amazing. This has got major legs. It's got major momentum. Why do anything? We're not in that same category, but does it make sense for us to just, are we a brand of sorts too? Should we just like keep trucking in the same way they're obviously going to keep trucking? You know, I don't know.
One thing I think about is show lengths, you know, I mean, this is, it's like we're having our podcast stand up in public here, but
what we do,
but you know, I, over my course of listening to podcasts, which is I'm, you know, 10 something plus years of listening to podcasts. I started like way back. Dig Nation was like my big one. Right. But the thing is like, you know, I've come to appreciate 30-minute podcast episodes, especially like being a dad, because that's like at 2x, that's 15 minutes. That's like washing the dishes. Done. I listened to a whole podcast. I have a sense of achievement. So I've come to appreciate the 30-minute format over the hour format, you know, and not saying like I want to change Shop Talk, but like, you know, an hour web design isn't impossible, but it's a lot, you know, it's not, you know, it's a lot of a conversation. So anyway, I've just come to appreciate that 30-minute format. Not saying we should just switch.
There's even like success being had in shows with like a 5-minute format, you know?
Yeah. But like with Shop Talk, like if we were just like tomorrow, hey, 30-minute shows from here on out, let's go. You know, it almost seems like it's a different show. Like we should shut down Shop Talk and call it something else, you know, because that format changed so dramatically.
Or keep the brand and really go deeper on seasons, or have it like, you know, like when show, like, you know, I don't know, Star Trek Atlantis, Serial. You know, this is Shop Talk Brief, you know, I don't know. There's like
Shop Talk Light.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. We're just having our stand up in front of you. So maybe if we do this, people will weigh in, which of course we want to know.
I think what we want to know, if you can hit us up on Twitter, say like when you started listening ish, you know, like episode number ish. And then, I don't know. Is that all we need to know?
I guess. And just like, how you feel about the show in general. There's also business considerations here too. It's like we often try to sell to sponsors for things, you know, and that sometimes we do and sometimes we don't. But like, does that change in a 30-minute show? Could people still stomach two sponsors if we go to it? Or is that like too much advertising for too little talking kind of thing? Or
yeah. Yeah. You know, that kind of knocks on something I've been thinking about, like sponsored content or like crowdfunded content. I've started doing that, like chipping into to places.
I saw your post on that. You kind of have like a public table of like, this is what I'm going to support right now. I think it's cool too. It's in the air too. I mean, Patreon is massive. And just, you know, everybody and their sisters got one, and it's kind of neat. Like, I wonder if everybody, you know, had like $100 budget, or if you can afford it. You know, I'm not trying to be exclusionary of folks here, but those of you who have some money to spend, if you don't get the newspaper these days, or you just canceled your Hulu account or something, can you redistribute that to something that, I don't know. I thought of it in context of the Keyframers. Have you seen that? It's like they've only done one episode of it, but it's Stephen Shaw and David Korsha doing like a live coding of animation. Like they took, like on their episode one, they took like a pretty complicated UI thing. I think they grabbed it off Dribbble, and then I think they threw it in some app that allowed them to scrub through a really high quality GIF, so you could just pull back and forth and see how the animation unfolded. And then they coded it together. And it's kind of, you know, to me, of course, it's extra interesting to me because they did it in collab mode in CodePen. But like, you know, and it was like 2 hours of Twitch, but they like took their time and laughed their way through it essentially, and came up with redid this animation, and they got a chance to talk about all kinds of web development concepts on the way. It was great. And they have a Patreon for it. So I'm like, oh, I got to get in on that, you know?
Dude, this means we should reboot the original pilot, Chris, of the show, CSS Drinking, and where we open Web Inspector and mess with people's websites while under the influence of...
It was a great idea that we was underserved. You know, video's hard, but we could do it.
Yeah, but you can just get ripped and open Web Inspector. That's
we could call it Fear and Loathing in the Web Inspector. Fear and Loathing in DevTools.
It could also get very inappropriate and very offend very many.
That's what happened in the pilot episode, so it's not it's going downhill.
It's true. So I guess like, I would be interested in crowdfunding, too. Like, is Shop Talk something you would actually support, you know, like, financially? Not saying, like, we like our... I think the incentives are great. Like, you get a podcast for free. and then we can do a podcast. And then, you know, companies who want to talk to you, like, they pay a fee to you know, like, just try to get you to use their product. I think that's like a pretty good incentive. You know, that's how TV works. But, you know,
There's other
models. I'm interested in this crowdfunding model. Just like, you know, if you like Shop Talk, pay for it. I don't know. it'll always be free. There'll be some free version, but maybe there's, you know, special bonuses or something, or a chat room or something.
The whole world is struggling with this idea. You know, like you want the best of both worlds. You want, like, I want it to be free, but I'd want the business part of it to work too. And I like the idea of crowdfunding, but I'm not sure what to give people that do the crowdfunding. It's just like, these are hard questions that the world is struggling with right now. So we've managed to get 9 minutes into this thing without getting into the meat though. So maybe we should do it.
So that's good. We should switch over to talking about the weather. Hey, Chris, the weather. hey, all right, here we go. Hey, cracking knuckles here. We have a follow-up on Gutenberg, is this right?
Just, you know, we had one email come in that said, you know, you had, like, what was it? Episode 298, we had Tammy Lister and Matthias Ventura on. They both work at Automatic, and it was the show about Gutenberg, which I found fascinating, the upcoming thing to... the change of the editor to WordPress itself, you know, and it's kind of a big deal in their world, and it looks pretty cool in a lot of ways. But was, you know, even in the show, we talked about this is very controversial. But Jimmy Smutek, I guess, wrote in and saying, well, it was a bit one-sided of an episode, though, because, you know, you had two guests on that are heavily invested in this and work for the company and, you know, are, of course, hesitant to even... perhaps even address the controversy or give it any weight. You know, it's like you have so we've covered, I feel like in the past we've done a decent job at like hosting a panel in which that there are multiple viewpoints and they kind of have at it with each other. Not too often, but once in a while. Like remember the CSS&J episode a million years ago was kind of like that. But in this case, it's not like we brought in somebody who hates Gutenberg and somebody who loves Gutenberg or works on Gutenberg and let them have at it. It just wasn't that kind of show. I'm not sure that we'll that the plan for the future of ShopDoc is to always have an argument kind of show. Like, I don't mind having just people who work for a place talk about their thing in a way. And we can attempt to do the job of bringing the controversial viewpoints up or whatever. I don't know. It's just we'll do what we want. Damn it. It's our podcast. But the point here.
Well, maybe that's another brand of the podcast. Shop Talk : yell at
people. Yeah. Fight
and,
Club.
And we just Fight Club. Shop Talk Fight Club.
But we'll give voice to this one. It was kind of interesting. One of them, you know, he brought up a few like criticisms of Gutenberg in a way. One of them was a tweet by Amanda Rush. Here, I'll just read it. Dear the WordPress, you know I love you like family, but I'm testing Gutenberg with JAWS right now, and we really need to have an honest discussion about where this is going, including discussions from other concerned developers. And it's a thread in which she goes on to talk about like it's in bad shape and it doesn't seem likely with the timeline that there's enough time to address the accessibility issues of this before it seems like it's going to go out. Which is that's more than valid. That's extremely concerning. And like the question is like, is there public addressing of this? What are those problems exactly? Is this 100%, you know, accurate? It would seem strange to me to see WordPress drop this thing with like incredibly horrible accessibility issues in it. Like I could see that holding up the release of it. So it hasn't dropped yet in core. You know, there's a plugin for it, but obviously that's optional to include. And that's where development of it is happening in. So like, I don't think any wrong has been done here yet because it's in active development and not shipped, of course. So we'll just have to see, like, are they actually going to ship it with major accessibility issues? That would seem weird. If they do, that's a big problem, it seems like. And I don't know. So there's that going on, you know?
Yeah. I mean, like, I think that is a huge concern, especially for WordPress. You know, I've been thinking about this lately. It's you don't, you know, sometimes successful things like, you know, or old things that are successful, you probably can't even measure what being screen reader accessible, it like the impact of that, you know, over the years, why people chose WordPress over, you know, text pattern or whatever, you know, like you probably can't even measure that benefit from over time. So it is like very important. I'm not criticizing Amanda as feedback because I think it's probably true.
And
I think
I should make clear that Amanda didn't just like superficially test this. She tested the crap out of it. She posted tons of problems with this and wrote it all up. And there's WordPress is reaching out. The WordPress has a page called Gutenberg Accessibility Testing, which they're keeping up to date on this stuff. Like there's a lot of back and forth here. I didn't mean to just be like, I'm going to read one person's unhappy tweet or whatever. Like this goes deep.
Yeah. I think that's the thing too. It's easy, I guess, to say something's wrong but it's hard to be like, here's the itemized list of issues I found, you know, which I think Amanda eventually got into and I think these are being like upstreamed appropriately. So I think that's like important thing. Like I just,
it's true. Here's like another example of something that is tricky is there's this Greg Shep fellow, which I have no idea. This is the first time I've ever come across him, but it was pointed out by Jimmy who wrote in. And it seemed to me like everything Greg has to say publicly right now is like anti-Gutenberg. He's made like his public tech identity anti-Gutenberg in a way that seems slightly less productive, I'm sorry to say. Like, maybe that's not fair, but it's like there's all these blog posts like how to disable Gutenberg and just, you know, this, it's anti-Gutenberg. And that's okay. Like, if you see something wrong in the world, it's your right. And God, you should have the power to publicly speak out against it. Like, there's, it's activism in a way. So, please don't, I'm not saying he shouldn't be doing this, you know, like, nah, you know, sees something, what he feels is wrong in the world and is talking about it to the, as much as he possibly can, you know?
Well, I think that's kind of a good thing about WordPress is that it's a plugin architecture. It, you know, it is, the editor's always like such a core piece, but like bring your own editor. Sure. Like you like the old one, do that. Like, is there another one that's even better? Great. Let's do that.
Well, that's the tricky part is this is going to go to core and probably not have a default way to turn it off other than another plugin to turn it off, which is that does change things a little bit when it becomes the canonical no default choice to turn it off kind of thing. That's a big deal.
Well, I understand that from a product perspective, though. You just,
and you want people to use like, it. You can't have it be opt-in. No, you ain't going to use it.
Yeah. Yeah, everyone will turn it off, you know, for version, the first version. So you kind of got to just force people onto it. It's going to be a tough go, but
anyway, there's other voices.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll try to make sure we have maybe more rounded dissenting opinions next time. We have experts on the show. Next question, Chris, is from Ed Bummings. And he said, Ed, like Ed, Bummings, as in multiple bummers. So there you go. Thank you, Ed, for the lol. As somebody who's still wading the waters into React, I'm wondering what YouTube made of it upon its initial launch. I began taking web development seriously a little over 2 years ago and was always hammered into following the orthodox separation of concerns, all caps. This approach made a lot of sense to me and has always kept it in mind when assessing and constructing all the components of a project.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that really throws me off with React, however, is the use of JSX and mixing HTML into JavaScript. When I was learning Node and EJS to do the same thing, compile JavaScript in my HTML documents, and it always rubbed me the wrong way. Not to mention, it was a mess to format. Okay, yeah, I agree. Later, I found various packages, plugins to handle that part, but I'm left to believe that EJS is essentially the same thing as JSX in that it's a means of handling JS in my HTML documents. Am I wrong? I'm wondering what you both make of this both then and now, and do you foresee JS and HTML as a trend that will continue in front-end frameworks? Is this a good thing?
Well, this is just a massive question. And unfortunately, there's forks of this conversation that just lead to bad places, which is just like, if you're fundamentally entirely opposed to the idea of JavaScript constructing HTML and injecting it onto the page, then the conversation is just over. You know, like, okay, well, you don't like that, so we can't talk about it then, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But there's the idea of like, okay, I get it. Sometimes JavaScript needs to make some HTML and put it on the page. Then the API style question comes up. Then it's like, okay, well, what are you okay with? And so these days, like if we're talking ES6, it's gotten a lot better because you can, for example, use no frameworks at all, but use the backtick characters to create HTML, which feels pretty nice. You know, it's this, what do they call those, template literals? And it allows you to kind of piece together a piece of HTML a heck of a lot easier than you've ever been used to. And you're like, hey, that feels kind of good. It's weird because it's certainly not JSX because that's its kind of own beast that we can get to in a second. But it does feel like, well, now I've constructed a piece of HTML in JavaScript and I can do with it what I will, you know, make a document fragment, just dump it in the DOM or whatever I'm going to do. So you don't really need a framework to, you know, necessarily to create some HTML and put it. Not that you ever needed to before, but it's just kind of easier than it ever was. But JSX is this format that's, it's funny because it looks like and is some HTML and JavaScript. You know, it's just this, it's the syntax, which it looks completely bizarre. And there's definitely like this quote unquote JSX hole that you can get into where it, there's no way that it doesn't rub you the wrong way the first time you see it. And then you kind of, I think, I don't know, at least to deep JavaScript developers, you kind of come out of that hole and you're like, oh yeah, it starts to look normal to you. But it's not like a template literal. It's not really a string. What JSX is, it's kind of like an API to creating some HTML. And there's a, it compiles down to a big elaborate, you know, create element, create element, create element kind of thing. So it, you know, it's kind of like pre-processes down to JavaScript APIs for creating a bunch of HTML. So it's kind of just like a convenience, but it's, I think a lot of people really like it. I'd say I'm pretty on board with looking at JSX these days. It looks nice. It looks like, oh, this is, I get it. This is, it's creating this chunk of HTML, but it gives me some powers like, oh, I'll just put my click handlers right here and, you know, use my props over here and I'll use the data that gets passed in over here. And I kind of can look at a piece of JSX and kind of understand it right away, what's going on, or I can't so much if I'm like create element P, you know, add event listener, you know, the things, it kind of separates things in a way that makes it harder to understand. So when you're looking at JSX, it just, there's some cognition that happens that's pretty quick that I like. But like I said, if you just don't like that idea that this chunk of HTML is just has been created in a way that is entirely dependent on JavaScript, I don't know what to do for you.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I mean, I think JSX and EJS are kind of different things in my brain.
Well, if it's created on the server, then isn't that like, it kind of doesn't matter what you do because it's coming across as HTML on the front end eventually anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like EJS would be more like the kind of, I guess, back end side of things. It actually has more of like a almost like a liquid syntax, you know. It's pretty like standard templating language. JavaScript is way more like, or sorry, JSX is way more like we're doing everything with JavaScript. And to the separation of concerns thing, I think it absolutely violates that. I think that gives me the heebie-jeebies a little bit. But it kind of back to what you said, like if you oppose HTML being written or generated by JavaScript, then you probably do not like EJS or JSX, you know. But, you know, in a React component, typically you have just a render function that is your HTML block, you know. But I say that with the caveat that that is never true. You have like other functions that also render out some things, like within that render function, you know, you call like sub functions or private functions to render out some more HTML based on conditional if statements and blah, blah, blah.
There's so, also this combination, like it's like, we're kind of saying if JSX, then your app ships, like in a no JavaScript situation, your app ships no HTML whatsoever. It's completely inaccessible. It's just gone, nothing, white page of nothing, which isn't necessarily true. This always gets brought up, and there's multiple sides to this kind of quote unquote argument too, but there are ways to server side render an app that uses JSX. I mean, there's ways to do that.
Just no one does it.
That's exactly right. That's the other side of this coin, is that it's very rare to see, I'd say, you know, like, and it's unfortunately harder than it should be, probably.
I don't know. I mean, if you think JSX in a lot of ways, just the way I feel like it gets, or a React component or whatever, just the way that it gets coded out with like functions calling functions that render little pieces of HTML and like all, they all kind of just return HTML, these little functions all the way up. In some ways, it's like React components are basically PHP on the client. You know, it's a lot like that in my brain, for all the good parts and all the bad parts of PHP are happening on the client. So, if that helps you think about it, you know, it you know, I think we're kind of past the tipping point on whether or not you can call this good or bad. Does that, that's a bold statement, but I'm going to stick with it. I think it's happening. So I think it's kind of like, how do we do it well is sort of the question. You know, I think if you don't like React, I think Vue has a really great separation of concerns. It still is kind of the all JavaScript thing, but it's very clear, right? Like this is HTML, this is CSS, this is your JavaScript that interacts with that kind of almost pseudo HTML, or I guess HTML enhanced, you know, it's kind of got some custom things living in the HTML. Also Angular, I've been working on some Angular projects. Angular is also one of these, like you very much try to write, like when you actually spit out an Angular component with the Angular CLI, you get an HTML file, a CSS file, and a TypeScript file. And then when you build it, it all bundles up. However, Angular does that. So
do you ship, like when you're working with Vue or Angular, like there's an HTML document that like comes down with like some, as I always look at, like there's like ng directive or whatever, there's like a list item that says, you know, for whatever, it makes like a loop of itself. So like that stuff with those weird attributes on it comes down right in the HTML. So now you have this like weird kind of like Frankenstein HTML object that's like, it's not nothing. There's some HTML there, but it's pretty useless without the JavaScript running.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just a body tag. I mean, you know, that's what they all are. It's a body tag with an app element inside of it. You know, there is, Angular has a thing called Universal Angular. That is kind of their take on the render. You know, you put some kind of node process in front of it to render something beforehand. But, you know, again, it's kind of, those are always weird to me because it's usually like some kind of stale data and then you like load the page or it's like one of those skeleton screens, which I don't think anyone wants, but it's like you load the page and then, you know, things start blinking like, hey, we're loading the actual data. Sit there for a bit. Okay, we got the actual data. That thing you're looking at is now gone. We've replaced the page for you. And, you know, it's like when you log into Facebook, you're like, oh, interesting. My friend had guess they didn't have a baby. I'll never know about that because now it's gone. So
It's so tricky. I hate to say this, but I think I'm pretty close to being done with the caring about the, what is the Node.js scenario. And I know that's not the greatest way to think and act and behave in the world, but it's like, it doesn't mean I don't care about accessibility. It doesn't mean I don't care about performance. It doesn't mean I don't care about semantics. It doesn't mean any of that stuff. It just means that like, I'm not sure. It's like, it's so hard to make a site that works in kind of both ways that it's just like, why? I know that sometimes JavaScript doesn't come down off the wire the way that you want it to, but sometimes HTML doesn't either, and sometimes images don't, and sometimes CSS doesn't, and all of those are catastrophic.
Mm-hmm.
In a way that it's just like JavaScript is just one of the party, and hopefully it runs. I feel like that's horrible, but like I don't know. Just I think it's if your number one goal in life is to make sure that you can turn off JavaScript in your browser and your website's exactly the same as it was otherwise, man, you're in for a long haul of work there for kind of questionable return.
Yeah. I mean, the alternate like route is, like you code the static views. I'll actually disagree with you.
You can take
I'm
it.
On
Absolutely.
Team disagree. I like Rails. I want to make Rails apps. I want to do that. Mm-hmm. I like that. I write a server thing, and maybe Rails has this new thing called Action Cable, which is kind of for the like real time data updates and whatever. I mean, like, is it really that bad? I don't know. Like,
well, that's another way to do it. And right? isn't that it? Can't you turbo links it up too? And then you just get like a ton of
turbo links.
I know it's old school, but turbo links does a lot, you know, and you, now you have like a totally server side rendered entire app that gets a lot of benefit from a little bit of front end JavaScript, but it's the front end JavaScript doesn't create any HTML. It doesn't create any content. All it does is be like, oh, I see you clicked on a link to another server side renders view. Let me go get that server side rendered view and just kind of plop it on the page for you and change the URL. And so it feels a little quicker because it doesn't, you don't have to do the like full page refresh to do it. It's not nearly as efficient as React, I should say. It's not, it's just flopping out the whole body tag. It's not doing DOM efficient changing. And it's not dealing with like, oh, I see some data has changed somehow client side, so I'm going to re-render what I need to handle client side. I don't think it, if you can go that route, I encourage you to. I think it's cool. I think it's resilient, it's powerful in its own way, but there's another whole style of app that just has too much state-changey kind of stuff happening client side that you need to handle, and re-rendering the entire page every time some little piece of state changes is not practical.
Yeah. Yeah, but here's my dissenting opinion. Yeah. Man, we are like one question into this thing. Okay.
I know.
So worked on a React app and it was fine. Wrote like something like 1,200 lines of JavaScript for a thing that basically just hit an API and spit out a spreadsheet, right? And there was some like mapping stuff you had to do, and that would have been a pain to like code up and dynamically do stuff. But you know, if I was doing it like in Rails, it would have just been very, very easy, you know, like, cause the thing about React is like, you have to get into like, if you're like, okay, I'm taking over the DOM guys, I got it, I'm in charge. Now you're responsible for coding up every error state function and how all that works. You're responsible for like coding up, you know, like kind of every path, every loader that shows up on the screen. You have to like drop in a UI loader or whatever. Like you have to do all of it. You have to basically program every single like bit and bobble that happens in your UI, because you've said, we're not server rendering everything. I'm doing it all here in this JavaScript file. Mm-hmm. You know, when you look at something like Rails form helper, man, that's awesome, because if the server kicks back a problem, it's like, oh no, don't worry, I'll just render out stuff. I do that. That's something I already have been programmed to do. I'll like render out little form errors for you and label every single error that had an error with a class of error. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So in some ways, server-side rendering effing rules, because like, who wants to code that over and over? That's awful. And so like, I often wonder, like I wrote 1,200 lines of React code, just to like hit an API and spit out a spreadsheet. I'm like, was that 60 lines of Rails code? And granted, there's a lot happening underneath, you know, the hood. I get a lot of benefits from using like a antique framework.
Well, isn't there performance benefits as well? Like if it's server-side rendered, what's coming across the wire is fully formatted, ready to go, HTML, CSS, and whatever little client-side JavaScript you need, but it's got everything it needs to render right away. So that first render is actually going to be, it's going to beat a client-side rendered app. It's just faster, but it's going to lose to dynamicness. You know, I don't know. It just depends. We're talking so abstractly that's tough to talk about here. But let's say you need just some tabs in your server-side rendered app. Then it's like, I don't know, what, are you back in jQuery land here? I suppose you are, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think the you know, canonical example is like a to-do list or something. If you had every time you checked a to-do, if it submitted a page and then refreshed the whole list, you know, that would feel super clunky.
It would. Your Rails in the to-do project would lose.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it would probably be like 500 megs. but, you know, like, can you, though, like, just sort of, you know, Rails also kind of has this, you know, WordPress-y style API endpoints as well, because it's all REST based, right? Very strict REST. So, you know, you can kind of just, I guess, eagerly animate that thing to be in a check state and then go hit the and wait for a success. And then if there's a problem, then come and handle the error on the client side, you know, kind of layer a JavaScript experience on top of it. You know?
Yeah.
And that's the thing too, is sometimes that can be a very thin experience. I mean, I'm coding it in my head right now. It's like 30 lines of JavaScript, you know, versus like a giant React project.
Yeah, they're not necessarily mutually exclusive, is what you're saying. So people are listening to this conversation. They're like, oh, well, it's either Vue, Ember, React, whatever, versus Rails.
Mm-hmm.
You can like have a Rails app that spits out a somewhat empty view, or maybe even a full view. I don't know. And then React takes over a piece of that somehow. And then when it needs to do things dynamically, like check a to-do list item off, that it can still use like Active Record to do that. You can still build like a Rails API behind that in which to accept that data, change the data in the database. There's a tweet by Guillermo Rauch, I think is that his name, that does like Next.js and Zeit,
Hyper.
All that cool stuff, who said that, I think React is such a good idea that we're going to spend the rest of the decade contemplating it. And I thought that was interesting. I don't know. Like, I think he might be right about that. Like, this is these frameworks are a big friggin' deal. And I don't think that they're a trend in front-end development. They're not just like a, oh, wow, that was a weird hole we went down. Hey, we're back to PHP or whatever. I don't think it's going to happen.
That's what I mean. Is it's like, I think that we've crossed the tipping point. So where it's just a thing you have to accept sort of in development. And you know, maybe that's what part of that WordPress disagreement was as well. Like, it's a React app. It's like JavaScript rendered stuff, but like, you know, now it's like, okay, we have that, but like, it has accessibility problems. How do we get around that? You know, like I.
Oh, and I'm sure they're very complicated. Like, oh, a new block just appeared on the page. What ARIA? Don't you have to like ARIA announce that somehow or whatever? And doesn't the source order matter in some way? And what happens when it goes away? And how do you manage focus and all that? I bet that stuff is way tricky.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So anyhow. All right. Well, we should do it. We'll do it. Next question. Are you ready?
Sure. Yeah. Let's do it.
Yeah. Question number two, Terry Otto writes in, would you guys address the subject of scammer clients and how to tell a scam?
So this is an email that Terry got. So I guess it's, you know, it's three paragraphs. Maybe I'll just speed read it. Will that work? Here's a spammy email or that he thinks might be a scammer client. Good day. I have a small clothing business for both male and female, which I run here in Fairbanks, Alabama. Now I'm trying to, or Alaska maybe, isn't Fairbanks Alaska. In Alaska, but it's yeah. AL. So that's already a weird sign. Now I'm trying to expand the business, and I want you to build an informational website for advertisement and to increase my sales rate. I need you to check out this site, but I need something more perfect than this, if possible. MissRebel.co.uk. The site would be informational only, so I need you to get back with me for an estimate for the web design. The estimate should include hosting, and I want the site to have not more than 8 pages, since it's informational. I have a private project graphic designer. He has the text, content, images, and logos for the site. I want English only. I don't have a domain yet, but the domain I want is Scott Wares. I shouldn't even say these. They're probably whatever. Yeah. You will be updating the site for me. I'll provide the images, logo, and content for the site. I want the site up and running before the end of June. My budget is $2,000 to $8,000. Kindly get back with me an estimate and whatever. So that's the email. And Terry is wondering, like, this seems like BS to me, but is it? Mm-hmm. Or why? Or how? Or what are they trying to get out of you? Well, how is it a scam? I don't know. They're trying to pay you money, aren't they?
Yeah. Well, first of all, your estimate is 8,000, the higher end of what they just said. But you know what's interesting? Can I give you my red flag that they want an e-commerce site. Okay. And then the pitch says the site would only be informational. So I need to get, you know, so you need to do this for me. And the estimate, it's only 8 pages. And it's like, if you've ever worked on an e-commerce site, it is not 8 pages. It's at a minimum like 17 templates. You know, you have the home template, the category template,
cards,
product
template,
the checkout flow, the admin stuff. You know, like it's the thank you page. You know, like I just listed, I guess, 8 pages there, but it's like it is just not that simple. And it's never so like.
But isn't even the deeper concept here is that they don't even want a website, right? This is a scam of some kind. So like, these are just evil people. How are they trying to extract money out of you?
Yeah, that's what I don't understand. I suppose it's possible that they are not Scott from the Scott clothing company. So they probably are just trying to. They sold something for something, you know, twice as much, and they're trying to get you to provide it for free.
Oh, you think they really do want a website, and they're just going to resell it?
Well, they probably want your code. They want you to build a thing, and then they're going to not pay you or something. And then, you know, good luck getting money from an international company or whatever.
Yeah, maybe they got the custom design, and they have some black hat kind of version of Envato or whatever.
They'll put your work on a template site, and then now you're just kind of like, wow. I don't know. I guess I'm making up a scam, but they'll put your work on a template site and just sell it 10 times over. You know, like it does not sound correct. I mean, you know, they could be phishing. I think, I don't know. I think you could possibly like just keep pressing them for questions, you know, like, all right, can you tell me a bit more, you know, like, I don't know, just about your product or what you do or what, you know, so.
I don't know what the scam is. I can't sort it out either. I like that they're going to just take your thing and not pay you, but they're going to resell it somewhere else. That's probably the most likely thing here. But, I mean, I guess there's some chance that they're just a terrible email writer and it's just coming across as spam, but it's not really. But I don't think so. I think this is very tricky here. But certainly, Terry, if you think it's spam, and it doesn't mean you can't email them back. It's not like the second you email them back, they have your credit card number or something. I think it's safe to engage with a little bit, if nothing, just for the laughs of it, to see what their next question is. You know, maybe their next question is so absurd that it immediately outs them. You know, just like, oh, hey, I lost my credit card in the gutter. Could you send me your credit card to register a domain with? Or it's just something insane like that.
Yeah. Can you send me your bank account information so I can
pay you? So I can pay you?
Yeah. Pay you? Uh-huh. Yeah. I think there's a, it gives me, I don't know, just from the client side of things, it seems like they keep trying to just say it's only informational. It's only informational. It's never only informational. So
yeah, I can see how this gets some people sometimes to, or at least gets them to engage, because I think there's probably plenty of people in the world when they get an email from somebody that wants to pay them $2,000 to $8,000. $8,000. That's a lot of money to a lot of people. That's a ton of money to me. I want $8,000.
Mm-hmm.
I'll slap together you an 8-page site, even though that won't be what it will be for that much money. I mean, I won't, but I could, or I could see how that is appealing.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, so stay safe out there, kids. I don't know. Just keep talking. Vet them. If it sounds interesting, just keep vetting.
Hey, I'd like to welcome a brand new sponsor here on Shop Talk Show, the widely beloved DigitalOcean. I just learned that they have the coolest redirect mini URL, DO. Like DigitalOcean, do.co. The URL that matters to you is do.co/shoptalk, because if you go to that, you get $100 of infrastructure credit. Very generous of them. To use that DigitalOcean, it's like a host, but it's the hostess with the mostest. It's the easiest cloud platform to deploy, manage, and scale applications of any size, removing infrastructure friction, providing predictability so developers and their teams can spend more time building software that customers love. Heck yeah! There's so many tutorials on DigitalOcean to tell you what you need to do the things that you need to do. It's just fantastic. So, it's all about deployment and scaling and making that easy. And you get $100 if you go to do.co/shoptalk. Thanks so much for the sponsorship, DigitalOcean. That's fantastic.
All right, Shane O'Sullivan writes in, my company is working on a number of web apps and we plan to white label out to customers and partners. We got a nice component library going in Vue.js, which is great for creating modular reusable components across various apps. However, here it comes. It's about to drop. I'm wondering what the approach would be for swapping out key style elements, i.e. colors of fonts, for each white label deployment. I'm currently experimenting with a Vue global mixin to create a style config that gets used in every component, but it seems like overkill. How would you approach this? Maybe some top level classes that we set for each project?
We even talked about this just like a couple of weeks ago, right? Like somebody was, we have this site that, you know, we don't want this one CSS framework that wants to work on lots of sites. How should we name our SAS variables? Remember that one? This is kind of similar. And I think there wasn't there a Brad Frost post just last week that was about themable design systems? So we should certainly link up that because he kind of goes into how you might approach that. Certainly, I think the way that I would think about this first is, okay, we got this white label product. One of the features of this white label product is people can theme it up so it looks like them. What are the checklist of features that we need to offer to make this compelling? You need to be able to upload your logo. You need to be able to pick some colors. You need to be able to pick some fonts. What else? Get the list together first and make it the list. Make sure every stakeholder checks off and agrees on this list. Then find the technological solution to make it happen. What I'd worry about is that target shifting around and you having to shift around your technological solution to make it happen in a way, then that freaks me out a little bit. Like, I'd want to know, like, okay, this is what's themable. This is what I'm going to make themable. I'm going to make like a mini framework to make this thing work in some way and kind of make it happen. The Vue thing makes me a little nervous. It seems like a little too specific of it. Even if the site is built in Vue, I'd be like, I think what I want to make here is some kind of like UI, like pick the font here, pick the color here, upload the technology here, and have like a data structure for that, and have that data structure spit out like a chunk of inline styles that overrides the rest of the stuff on the page for that. And that doesn't seem like it necessarily needs. Then if you need to make that work in Vue, make that work in Vue, but at least you have a idea and technological solution that will work no matter how you build a website.
You know, is it a Viljami, I'm murdering the pronunciation of your name, but there's a Vue design system thing, which is kind of like a pattern library in Vue. You may want to check out or at least hit Viljami up because I know he's done a lot.
It's been popular lately, hasn't it? But remember, there's another level on top of this. It's not just build the design system, which you'll probably need to do anyway, but now there's now allow that design system to be customized. And it may or may not be adaptable to that.
Yeah. One thing I'd look at is CSS variables. I love them. But if you have to support IE 11, ouch, it gets really rough. So you'll have to kind of come up with something. I would think if you're white labeling stuff and just kind of letting people skin it, I mean, I think it would be great to have like a configurable thing, like this global mixin kind of view component. The problem is if you wrote it in SAS, you know, the only way to override that is through inline styles, but maybe you can do that. Maybe you can kind of fake using Vue, kind of fake a CSS variable sort of thing. That's all JavaScript powered and inline styles. So yeah, that's something to
my
think
experience
about.
Here is what I talked about. My method here is that in CodePen, we offer you to theme your embed. And so it's not the entire website, but it does have the same kind of element. It's this component in which you have lots of control over. you know, you can pick like 8 different colors that colorize different pieces of the thing, and you can hide and show different parts of it and select which tabs are open and such. And you can, even on top of that, you can be like, I'm just going to attach this custom style sheet to it so I can do whatever I want in some way there. So that might be compelling too, especially for your customers, is like, here are some easy things you can customize, but if you want to just add your own style sheet, you can do that as well. And the way that we did it is just like, it barfs out a chunk of inline styles that have more specificity than the default colors. You know, like there's a default color mm-hmm. for that top bar, but the one you pick gets barfed out in a style block with slightly more specificity. So yours wins and it overrides that thing. And I think that was perfectly fine. And it was super low tech.
Yeah. You could have a secret ID, body ID override. And then you have to do pound override or body ID important. And then you type pound important mind classes and then you win. Is that how it works?
Yeah.
That could work.
Yeah. Right? I don't even, you know, you don't go as hardcore as important, but you could.
Override, pound override. So there you go. Hopefully that helps. Should we do? Let's do one more. We have a little bit more time, huh? Let's see. We got Stephen Briscoe writes in. I was wondering what the future of HTML, CSS, JavaScript developers with WebAssembly shipping in all major browsers. Should we all start learning C# and Java? Well, geez, we picked a good one to end on really quick.
Well, I'm sure neither of us know crap about this. But there's one thing that I know a little bit about WebAssembly is, first of all, it's like this. It's like an EXE of a website in a way, isn't it? Like it's like compiled already mm-hmm. so that it comes across the wire as like one chunk. I don't know how many chunks it needs, but you know, like one file, and then just like is rip roaring ready to go. Like there's, you know, when JavaScript comes across the wire, great. The browser gets it. It's text. It has to read it line by line, parse it, you know, execute it. Maybe there's errors. You know, there's all this like stuff that needs to happen. But if it's WebAssembly, it's just like, got it, done. You know, like it doesn't have to parse it and all that crap. My understanding is very loose, but I think it's faster in that way. And then it's just this prepackaged, ready to rock kind of thing. And what's kind of compelling about it is that it can be a compile target for your existing JavaScript. Like you're still going to author your site in JavaScript and whatnot, but it can be bundled into this WebAssembly format, which is kind of neat because then it's like browsers that support it, you can ship them that, and browsers that don't, you can ship your old thing in a way. And I think even Webpack can kind of help with WebAssembly and compile to that target.
I think you've described it perfectly. One other language you should maybe be looking at is Rust. A lot of the Mozilla people are into Rust mm-hmm. And I think they're writing a lot of tutorials and stuff to write in Rust, which is kind of like a C sort of language that then compiles to WebAssembly. And WebAssembly is like kind of like you said, it's almost like a pre-parsed JavaScript. Because when you download JavaScript, part of the time spent on the JavaScript is like parsing it into something a computer understands. And the more JavaScript you send, the more like parsing it takes. So in theory, WebAssembly skips that step and can even be parsed midstream. So if it has like half the file, it can be like, okay, I get all this. Where I think right now WebAssembly is kind of suited for, and I hear this is going to change, is kind of almost like worker loads, like, hey, go format this image and then come back or something, or encode this video or something like that. I feel like that's kind of where WebAssembly's wheelhouse maybe is intended, sort of like on a worker thread. Like, here, I'm going to give you this thing. You go do something with it. Come back to me. Like, tell me what you did with it. But I've also heard, you know, I don't know how it all works, but I think WebAssembly is also able to interact with the DOM and inject things into the DOM. So maybe you will actually be able to do, like, it may be a JavaScript replacement. I don't really know. But that could be interesting. I think there'll be an interesting wave of the future. I'm sure it's a long time off because basically you're inventing a new sort of scripting language that can be executed on a browser, which introduces a lot of security issues. So I'm sure they won't just do it really easily. But But yeah, I think that could be pretty interesting to see how that works, you know, whenever that shows up.
Yeah. Okay. It definitely is a bright future. I mean, anything that's just like, oh, hey, we changed this, or we're now offering this format that has like extremely wonderful performance and it can be handled by a build tool kind of thing. It's something to pay attention to, you know?
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out like what the like quintessential hello world for WebAssembly. Maybe we need to put together a WebAssembly.
That's a great idea.
Episode. We'll call our old friend Brendan. No, there's a lot of other people working on it. But yeah, I'd be curious what the hello world like. I don't know.
How can there not be one? There's got to be one.
Yeah. Like what? How do I use this now? That's the question I want to know. Mm-hmm. So anyway, all right. Well, let's wrap it up, Chris. We're hitting the 55-ish mark here, so we got to wrap it up. Thank you, dear listener, for downloading this and your podcatcher of choice. Be sure to star heart favorite it up. Share it on Twitter. That's how people find out about the show. If you want to follow us on Twitter, follow us at Shop Talk Show for tens of tweets a month. And please click where you're talking about for the first 8 minutes of the show. Let us know, like, when you picked up Shop Talk Show, what you like about it. Any feedback we would love to have at this point. You know, we're still going, so it's not the issue, but like we always just, you know, whatever. If you think there's something that could be way better, tell us that. If you think it's just great, keep doing it, tell us that. Just let us know. Would love to hear your feedback. So Twitter's a great channel for it. And so yeah, if you hate your job, head over to shopdocshow.com/jobs, get a brand new one. And Chris, anything else you'd like to say?
Dropdocshow.com.